The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Now, we all know that some people assume that the scientific life is dry and stuffy. Not you, of course, because you listen to this program. But just in case you need a reminder, on today's episode, we'll be talking about the dangerous and the hilarious sides of science. Welcome to Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. A little later on, Rochelle Saunders will speak to Derek Lowe about the chemicals that he absolutely refuses to work with, and for good reason. But let's start out with one of our favorite guests, Cy Curious, also known as Bethany Brookshire. Bethany has a BS in biology and a BA in philosophy from the College of William and Mary, a PhD in physiology and pharmacology from the Wake Forest University School of Medicine, and she recently finished a postdoctoral position at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. She was the guest editor of the Open Laboratory Anthology of Science Blogging 2009 and the winner of the Society for Neuroscience Next Generation Award and the Three Quarks Daily Science Writing Award. And she blogs at Scientific American, at the Cy Curious Brain, and at Scientopia at Neurotic Physiology. Welcome back, Bethany.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so you recently attended the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. Maybe give us a bit of background on that. What are they?
The Ig Nobel Prizes are, well, first off, it's like the best scientific ceremony you will ever go to if you can get a ticket, which they sell out months in advance. There are sections which include paper airplane throwing. There are sections where people in the audience are acknowledged and they have to stand up and spin in place counterclockwise 3 times. There's usually a word for each ceremony. So this year it was force. And every time someone said force, the entire audience had to go, force! It was great. It was great. My favorite part, and the part that I think they should institute into every single scientific ceremony, is there is a little 8-year-old girl. Her name is Miss Sweetie Poo. And if you go over your allotted acceptance speech time, Miss Sweetie Poo crosses the stage, stands in front of you, and says, "Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored." Until you stop.
Okay, so let's step back a bit. What are the prizes for?
So the Ig Nobel Prize were invented for science that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. It's the kind of science that looks really silly and sometimes even stupid at the outset, but actually can be extraordinarily important. And some of them are more self-evident than others. For example, last year, the Ig Nobel Prize in Neuroscience went to a guy who put a dead salmon in an fMRI machine for science, and then they ate it after it went through the fMRI. He said it was good. But it actually showed that there are wrong ways of analyzing fMRI data. And if you don't use the right controls, and if you do, you know, too many controls or too few controls, you can actually get a dead salmon to show activation in the brain when it's looking at colorful images.
So these pieces of research aren't necessarily intended to be funny then?
No, actually, they're often intended to be useful. And I mean, they often are. I think actually every single one of this year's was pretty well useful.
Now, on your blog, the Cy Curious Brain on scientificamerican.com, you went into very in-depth coverage of the winners. And of course, that's what I really want to talk about. Okay, first up, the Psychology Prize.
I love this prize. So this was the prize that showed the title of the study was just as good. Beauty is in the eye of the beer holder. So we all know what beer goggles are, right? The idea that after a couple drinks, you know, that person across the bar suddenly looks a lot hotter than they did before. Well, it actually turns out that the same thing applies to yourself. So after a couple of drinks, you look fabulous, darling. You're gorgeous. You're stunning.
And now the study design here was actually not bad, according to your blog post.
No, I thought the study design was pretty good. First, they actually interviewed a bunch of people in a bar. They asked them how attractive they felt they were and then took blood alcohol levels. And they found that people who rated themselves as being more attractive had higher blood alcohol. Now, that's just a correlation. Maybe attractive people drink a lot. You don't know. So they brought in another group of people and into the lab and gave them either real alcohol or a non-alcoholic drink with like a spritz of alcohol on the top to make people, to fool people. And it fools people pretty reliably. And then they gave people non-alcoholic beverages and told them they were non-alcoholic. And then after giving them all their drinks, they asked them how attractive they felt they were and had them record a commercial for the drink that they were testing. Then they had independent people rate the commercials for attractiveness, like how attractive the people in the commercials actually were. And what they found was people who think they have been drinking think they are more attractive. Not people who have been drinking.
Weird.
Just people who think they have.
So what's the effect there then? Why would that be? What's the mechanism, I guess I should say?
There's a couple possibilities. They certainly, the authors raised the possibility of lowered inhibitions. One person who I talked to about it, who is not a scientist, suggests that maybe a couple of drinks just decreases the amount you're willing to be humble in public. So it just brings out your bragging. I personally wonder if there's some very enterprising bartender out there inventing a placebo drink called Liquid Courage.
Wow. You better patent that right away.
I should. You're right.
Okay, on to the joint prize in biology and astronomy. And the title of this one is Dung Beetles Use the Milky Way for Orientation.
So I love this study for one specific reason. And it was a reason that they didn't mention in the Ig Nobel ceremony. And I didn't know until I actually read the paper. They put dung beetles in little hats. Little cardboard hats. They're the cutest thing you've ever seen on a dung beetle. Which I guess isn't saying much.
So, okay, tell us about the research, because it actually is super interesting.
For example, humans at first were thought to be one of the only types of animal that use the stars to navigate. And I mean, we do use the stars to navigate, you know, ship people sailing the open sea have done this for years and years. Recently, people have found out that actually seals navigate using the stars. And birds also use the stars to navigate. And they wanted to see if dung beetles do too. And this is actually, it was kind of a difficult hypothesis to make because dung beetles have terrible eyesight. They're really not particularly, you know, they don't see well. But it turns out actually they do navigate using the Milky Way. And the reason they looked into this was because dung beetles tend to congregate among piles of dung.
Fascinating.
Being dung beetles, right? And they take their ball and then they roll away their ball. Now, the thing is, if you find a nice fresh pile of crap, right, you're not going to be the only dung beetle there. The odds are there's going to be like a run on crap. So you need to get your ball and you need to get away as soon as you can. And so what they found is dung beetles are really good at navigating an almost completely straight line away from the pile of crap. What they found is when they put little cardboard hats on them that blocked their upper eyes from seeing the stars, all of a sudden they were wavering all over the place. They looked like the paths look like little drunk dung beetles are wandering around. And the same thing happened when they actually put away, like they, even when the moon wasn't out, when only... when the moon wasn't out, they could still navigate using the stars, unless they were blocked from doing it. They actually put them in a planetarium and had them roll their dung beetle balls around the planetarium with little cardboard hats on.
I have the best visual right now.
It's pretty great.
So this basically only qualifies for the Ig Nobels because it's about poop and dung beetles in hats?
I think there's partially that, but I think it's also dung beetles using the stars. The stars are such romantic things, you know? Like, you think, doves might use the stars, and seals, which are adorable, might use the stars, and humans, which are romantic, and dung beetles. Dung beetles have romance, too.
Okay, physics prize. Humans running in place on water at simulated reduced gravity. Do tell.
Yes, you too could walk on water if you and the water were on the moon.
Right.
Small details. Hey, it's the little things. And you have to be wearing fins.
Okay, let's go back. Again, what makes us currently not able to walk on water for those of us who don't know?
Well, physics. So basically, there are a couple of species that successfully walk or run on water. So for example, you have your water strider, which is extremely light and can actually, because it's got distributed weight on all those feet, right, it can actually support itself via surface tension. Then you have your lizard that can run on water. And it does that because it has these big old wide feet. And it's pretty small. Okay. And by using these big old wide feet and moving really fast, it can actually support itself on the water for short distances, running across the water. However, humans do not have nice big wide feet. We have narrow feet, and we're also really heavy. We would have to be running to stay on water on Earth something like 65 miles an hour to stay above the water. However, if you reduced gravity, we become lighter, and we wouldn't have this problem. So they actually took a bunch of people, put them in harnesses, gave them water fins, like those scuba fins, and had them run in water in various simulated gravities.
I would love a video of this.
Sadly, there is no video, but there's a photo.
It's not the same.
They did show the video at the prizes, but the video was not published in the supplemental materials. It's really sad.
What we've learned is that on the moon, we could run on water.
Well, not just on the moon. There's other planets that could do it too, or non-planets. So all of the moons of Saturn would qualify. Pluto, no longer a planet, but would qualify, would have the right gravity with it that would enable us. So I have this vision that someday when we colonize the solar system, running on water is going to be like a new Olympic sport in like 3014.
And the chemistry prize. This is actually, again, very useful. Plant biochemistry. An onion enzyme that makes the eyes water. So maybe let's start out with, what is it about onions that makes you cry in the first place?
It's actually something called lacrimal factor, lacrimatory factor. And considering that in Latin, lacrima means to cry, lacrimatory factor is extraordinarily well named. It's basically an irritant and causes you to cry. But it's actually, what's interesting is there are various enzymes that produce lacrimatory factor. So, for example, what you have is you have your first chemical, which is abbreviated Prensco, because you don't want to pronounce it, which is broken down by alanase into pyruvic acid and ammonia, which is broken down by propanol sulfenic acid. And this goes to propanthiol S oxide, which is lacrimal factor. That's what makes you cry. And the hypothesis used to be that this was just spontaneous. Once you hit that second to last step, it was just spontaneous degradation to this lacrimatory factor, and you were just screwed. But the scientists who conducted the study noticed that, for example, garlic has alanase and it also has Prensco, but it does not produce lacrimatory factor. You can cut garlic for hours and you won't cry. There's something in there that's actually causing the breakdown to the lacrimatory factor. And they were able to isolate it. It's called lacrimatory factor synthase because they are creative.
Right.
And then, being completely awesome, they said, well, if we can get rid of lacrimatory factor synthase, we can get rid of lacrimatory factor. So they did, and they created a genetically modified onion that produces no lacrimatory factor. And this is awesome because the other breakdown pathway that goes spontaneously actually produces thiosulfonate, which is part of what makes onions tasty. So the idea is it won't make you cry and it'll be more tasty. Unfortunately, we don't actually know how it tastes.
Well, why don't we know that?
Because it is not FDA approved for human consumption.
Right. Good.
So we don't know. They know that if they cut it, there's no lacrimatory factor.
But hypothetically, it should taste better.
Hypothetically, it should taste at least okay. I can safely say that I will be one of the first people to buy this because I have really strong reactions to lacrimatory factor. So I'll be all up on the tearless onion.
I think this is my favorite. Archaeology prize. Human digestive effects on a mammalian skeleton. So in effect, someone swallowed a shrew for science. Please explain.
Yes, I think of it as there was a young student who swallowed a shrew. Didn't even chew, just swallowed a shrew. It's what scientists do. I could go on. But yeah, so I met the guy again at the ceremony. He will not tell people who swallowed the shrew. He won't. He's going to take it to his grave, which is, you know, I understand that. You don't want to be known as the guy who ate the whole shrew for science.
I don't know. I think I would not mind that.
I mean, it was barely parboiled. It was basically raw. But he will admit that he was the one who had to sort through what came out to look at the digestive effects on the shrew skeleton.
Noted. Okay, so study design.
Sadly, he told me this after I shook hands with him.
No, yeah. that's not right. Okay, so how was this set up? Why? Why and how?
So the why, it's actually extremely interesting, and this is a very highly cited paper for what they found. Basically, when you find a human skeleton, say, in a cave from, you know, prior to the agricultural revolution, you know, you find an old skeleton. You often find other bones with it. Okay, sometimes there are other humans. Sometimes you find like fish or something. If you find a fish skeleton and the cave is nowhere near anything that produces fish or ever has been, you might be able to conclude, hey, a person probably ate this and this was a food item. If you find, say, a domesticated animal, you know, the bones of a domesticated animal, you might be able to conclude, and we have digestive signatures for these, but there's also all these like squirrels and mice, shrews, skeletons in these caves, right? So you sit there and go, well, did humans eat them? Or did they just like wander in there and die? You don't actually know. So what you need is a digestive signature. And this is specific to a species, a predatory species. And it's how your body breaks down bones of different sizes and types. So we have digestive signatures for things like owls and hawks and panthers, you know, things like that. But we did not have one for humans eating rodents.
I love this.
So this guy trapped a bunch of shrews, and then someone who will forever remain nameless ate marker foods. Basically, they're foods that come out somewhat obviously.
Corn.
Corn comes out obviously. And if you have no experience with this, just eat some corn and trust me. So they ate corn as the beginning marker food, and the end marker food was actually sesame seeds. And in between, someone swallowed the shrew, which was skinned, parboiled, and put into chunks so that it wasn't that difficult. I was informed that some tomato sauce was used to make it go down a little easier. And then the author took what came out for the next 3 days and analyzed it. First, he had to break it down and get the bones out with like
that
his
is
hand.
Not that's not the fun job.
And
that
some cheesecloth.
Is it worse to eat the shrew or go through the poop looking?
Oh, he told me, he goes, you know, okay, so first I tried to just do it fresh because it had to be dissolved in water. He goes, first I tried to do it fresh and he goes, and it was terrible. So I said, you know what? I'll let it sit for a bit. And he let it sit overnight and he goes, and that was worse. It was worse. But what's interesting about that is after that, they wanted to use a scanning electron microscope to actually look at the bones and how the bones had been broken down, which means they took the poop-coated bones, cleaned them, and then coated them in gold.
Wow.
Which is required for scanning electron micrographs, right. Creating the most precious set of poop-covered shrew bones the world has ever seen.
I literally, this is the best piece of research I have ever heard of.
Oh yeah, that's pretty great.
So what were the results then?
I unfortunately, I'm not a specialist and I don't understand the results, but they were able to find digestive signatures. They were able to say, for example, that we are between a number 2 and a number 4 level predator based on how many bones came out. So for example, some of the bones actually didn't come out. That's not to say they stayed in. It's to say that probably we were able to break them down completely, which makes us pretty good at that sort of thing. And they were also able to show pitting and, you know, various other breakdown, especially for things like teeth and like femurs, that have been able to create a digestive signature. And this means that when archaeologists find the voles in the cave with the human skeleton, you can actually go look at them with a scanning electron micrograph and say, ah, you see this pitting here. This is characteristic of human digestion. This squirrel was dinner before this dude died.
See, and this is why I love the Ig Nobels. This is exactly why, because this is science that makes you laugh and makes you think. Okay, now we are almost out of time, but I have to ask you, we won't get to all the winners today, unfortunately, but you can go read your blog posts about these topics. You've covered all of the prizes, and we will link to them on our website. But you also write the Friday Weird Science column on
yes.
scientificamerican.com. And so you see a lot of research that should probably be nominated for an Ig Nobel. So are there any studies that you personally would love to conduct? Ones that would probably end up with Miss Sweetie Poo telling you that she was bored.
That's tough. So one of the papers that I was particularly entertained by, I don't know about other ladies or men in the audience for that matter. I think kilts look awesome.
Yes.
I think they look spectacular. Yes. They like, it's not even a matter of like dude in a skirt, ha. Huh? It's just, it looks very masculine. You gotta own it. You know, a guy in a kilt looks great.
You will get, you know, no complaints from me about that. None.
I love them. And actually, I like, you know, girls in kilts, too. I think they look spectacular. But anyway, Scotsmen have these, you know, this reputation for wearing these kilts, which gives them extra suavity, in my personal opinion. But it also, according to this one guy who posted to the Scottish Medical Journal, he thinks that it actually will increase fertility, that there is anecdotal evidence that wearing a Scottish kilt has influence on reproductive potential. The paper was titled Real Men Wear Kilts. The idea was that wearing a kilt creates this ideal scrotal environment.
Huh.
Okay, because, you know, basically everything can swing free. There's space, breathability, right. You know. More importantly, it keeps the balls cool. Sperm does best when it's kept at a slightly lower temperature than body temperature, which is why your balls hang low in the first place. So the idea is that if you're not wearing underwear, which you're not supposed to wear with a kilt, you know, some people do, but you're not really supposed to, I guess, that the kilt and the free-flowingness of everything will create the ideal scrotal environment and cause, you know, increases in sperm count. But they never actually, they've just got anecdotal stories, which include things like strong psychological benefits.
Right, right.
And a man, giving a man a sensuous awareness of his own body and how it will be seen by others. That's a quote from the paper.
Oh. Well, aside from that, though, that's an entirely reasonable hypothesis.
Right, it is. But you gotta test it. And all he's got right now is anecdotes. Like, I want to see dudes wear kilts, you know, for the full 60 to 90 days that it takes for sperm to turn over. I want to see if the sperm count goes up.
Someone,
and it could be that you would be able to tell who was undergoing infertility treatment by who was wearing a kilt.
Someone needs to fund Psy. Like, desperately. If there are wealthy people out there.
I could start a Kickstarter for it.
Psy, thank you so much for the color commentary and for being here again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you guys.
You can check out all of Psy Curious's blog posts on the Ig Nobels on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. We'll be right back with Zay Frank after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by internet legend Zay Frank. Zay joined BuzzFeed in September 2012 as the Executive Vice President of Video. A web pioneer since 2001, he's known for creating viral projects like Earth Sandwich, Young Me Now Me, and Chill Out Song. And his website was listed as one of Time's 50 coolest websites. He's here today to talk about his True Facts series. Welcome to the show, Zay.
Hello. nice to join you.
Well, first off, and I think I speak for all of us when I say thank you for completely destroying a vast swath of potentially productive time.
You're welcome. It is educational, so it's not a complete loss.
So let's talk about True Facts. Tell us about the series.
Well, True Facts started as the first one I just put together was about a hedgehog and the notion of it. I've been doing some work around photographs and narration as a base for, you know, kind of exploring different sorts of videos that I was doing that didn't involve a face in front of a camera. And so I've done a few, and then I had the notion to try something around animals. And the first one was completely fictitious. So there weren't any facts whatsoever. And that was kind of the joke, was that it was, you know, true facts, and it made no sense. After the success of that one, it became pretty obvious that there was a big writing challenge. In writing complete nonsense, you're actually more limited in a way, because the quality of the jokes becomes the prime focus of the media. And so in thinking about doing the next few, I started to think about, you know, ways that I could incorporate actual information about the animals that I was covering, because it was pretty crazy what was going on. And that led me to thinking about what the nature documentary can become in the sort of online space. I think that overall the nature documentary has kind of lost its way a little bit. I mean, I think that there was a sort of there's definitely incredible stuff out there. I think about Attenborough and the Planet Earth series and things like that, which are incredibly amazing productions. But I think that with Discovery Channel and Animal Planet and things like that really pushing forward these 30 to 60 minute micro documentaries about particular animals or particular species, the trend is more and more become to anthropomorphize them and tell them as if they're sort of like vaguely stupid humans. I mean, I watched one on wolves hunting a moose, and the, you know, the way that they were talking about this animal's existence was, it was this sort of, I don't know, kind of pedestrian dumb human that was, you know, had some clairvoyance in terms of sniffing out bacteria that might have been on the moose's hoof. And I think that the reality of the animal world and, you know, thinking about the consciousness of these animals and then what it kind of means to be in the same living environment as these, you know, crazy aliens, it felt like it was a time to, you know, kind of almost do a send-up of that way of speaking about animals. That's what True Facts has become. I mean, there's over 20 of them now, and they tend to be, you know, a mixture of facts, real actual information about the animals, which is so crazy and bizarre you'd never write it, you know, on your own. And then humor, and the humor takes a number of different turns. I'm kind of playing with the direct information, but I'm also playing with the way that the host is interacting with the script. So yeah, it's a ton of fun. I mean, it's an endless challenge.
That's the thing. The key to all this is the narration, because the tone is brilliant. So how long did it take to get down that perfect level of pompous yet awestruck?
If you go back to the first one, which was the hedgehog, it's a very different voice. It's a much higher pitched voice, and a little bit more overtly silly. I forget what the second one that I did was, but I dropped my voice a bit and tried to make it a little bit more intimate. And then a number of people said that it sounded vaguely like Morgan Freeman. And then, so I think the third one that I did was, or maybe the fourth, I'm not sure, but it was True Facts about Morgan Freeman, and I did it in that voice. And that kind of, you know, dropping down into that register and that cadence solved some problems for me, which is that, you know, a lot of humor comes from the tension of, you know, some sort of serious setup being broken. And if you get too crazy and over the top, you know, that becomes where you have to stay. You can't really deviate from that. Whereas if you start at the bottom, really any deviation becomes, you know, something that can be delightful or unexpected or strange. So yeah, I've kind of settled into it, and you know, I've taken some breaks from it from time to time, but it's it works pretty well, and it sounds pretty good.
You know that you have been compared to David Attenborough, obviously.
I think that's a terrible comparison. For I don't know if he's Sir Attenborough or just should be, you know, he is a genius. I think that really did revitalize the nature documentary, or maybe it didn't revitalize it, or maybe it was just sort of the crowning achievement, because he, you know, he comes across as this very, you know, just approachable, fun person, but his, you know, the way that he narrated and this kind of like hushed relationship that he had with the viewer, almost like he was telling you a secret about something, you know, made those programs just infinitely entertaining. So he's a huge, you know, huge influence on me. I, a long time ago in 2006, I did a short video called Outside, which was a direct kind of homage to him, where I tried to do his accent. But it's hard for an American.
And I was wondering, how does it feel to know that your comedy series is potentially a more effective piece of science communication than big budget nature films, or maybe some of Attenborough's work?
I mean, I think that this is just the trend, you know, media that is tuned to the platforms that people are on and watching will do better. And so I think it's a pretty natural progression. And I think that to some degree, there's many formats that have gotten old. And I don't mean stale. I mean actually old. The nature documentary we're talking about, viewing audiences in their late 40s, early 50s. Even comedy news like Jon Stewart and Colbert, the average age is drifting into the 40s. So, you know, I think that there is a kind of an overall challenge right now of thinking about these different content categories that are aging and thinking about ways to refresh them a bit. And in some cases, that means, I think, taking some risks on, you know, maybe making it a little controversial and blending humor with information, blending media types, whether it be photographs and music and this sort of mixed media approach that I think is very online native. But I think that, you know, the content itself is incredible and it remains incredible, whether it be nature documentary or another category, which I'm very interested in, which is Americana. You know, the content is amazing and it's really thinking about what are some of the new opportunities to package it in a slightly more network native sort of way.
Now, what's the response from scientists been? Do they think that you're trivializing zoology or?
Oh, I don't think so at all. Good. No, I mean, it's been incredibly positive. I mean, I've been able to get footage from a lot of diverse sources, you know, from scientists themselves. Once in a while, I'll get a ribbing, mainly when I get something wrong. You know, for example, in this last cuttlefish video, I mistakenly put a bobtailed squid in one of the shots, and really, they're very, very similar looking, but it is a different species. So once in a while, if I get a fact wrong or something like that, you know, I'll get called out. And there are times where if I'm working with footage from a shelter or, you know, a particular kind of organization, they'll want to make sure that I'm not just, you know, making fun of the animal. But I've tried to stay pretty well within the, you know, like you said, awestruck vein. I mean, I am genuinely interested in animals, and I think it's actually a really great way to get the conversation started, especially with younger audiences who, you know, just don't know a lot of this stuff.
I have to ask, what is the oddest true facts request you've had?
Well, I get a lot of true facts about requests that are non-animal related. It's celebrities, really. Everybody just sort of wants true facts about their favorite celebrity, and I think, you know, once in a while there's the errant request for true facts about the male or the female, meaning the human. I think that's so, there's something kind of valid about it. I know that I think the connotation there is that they kind of want some sort of a sexist piece. But you know, the human body is completely fair game for this kind of stuff too, because I think that, you know, while we have the luxury of kind of looking at these creatures as if they're, you know, these vast oddities, we don't really know that much about our own bodies and our own morphology, and it's pretty incredible, you know. I don't know. I mean, the nice thing about this series is that it's kind of endless. I mean, it can kind of go on as long as there's interest, and I have the capacity to make them.
Well, I you know, if you happen to be taking requests, I know a lot of us would love to see a true facts about the scientist.
About the scientist? Oh my! Well, I have a lot of direct experience with that. My father is a fairly well-renowned scientist in the molecular biology world. I myself, you know, in college, that's what I was studying to be. I was in the neuroscience program at Brown University. It might be a little too close to home, that one.
I was wondering if you could potentially debunk some stereotypes or capitalize on them.
It's just, you know, it's such a broad category of people, really. You know, we would have to like focus down on like the, you know, the double-breasted, ring-necked scientist or something like that before we got to any specificity that I could really play with. Because in my time working and talking with people in the sciences, man, it's really exposed to a pretty broad range of personality types. They all look the same. You know, they all have arms.
All of them.
Yeah. I assume that the, you know, the bodies are very similar, unless there's, you know, a second brain somewhere that I know about.
I have to thank you personally for the true facts about the frog, because...
Oh, that was quite a coup. I didn't know what trypophobia was until I released that. I don't think that it is actually a recognized DSM phobia, but it turns out that many people feel very uncomfortable when they see lots of little holes, especially the holes that have baby frogs in them that come out. It's quite disgusting.
I have your dry heaving, sir.
Yeah.
You do a good dry heave, and I don't think I've ever actually said those words in that combination.
I imagine it. It's rough. There's definitely, you know, this format, because it is a little irreverent, gives me a chance to highlight some things that I think that a lot of the traditional nature documentaries kind of stay away from. Like, for example, I don't think that there has been much attention paid to the duck penis. It, just in terms of evolution and in terms of mating in birds, and probably just across species, really, it's just one of the most fascinating things. It never plays out like that. Like, usually you have some sort of evolutionary parity, but in that case, you literally have a corkscrewed penis that goes in one direction, and then a vagina that's corkscrewed in exactly the opposite direction, because sex has become so incredibly violent, but it's not something that you hear much about.
Except right? On my show. No, we've repeatedly talked because it's not just the corkscrewness, it's the secret chamber of the duck vagina.
And,
that is insane.
And they're barbed. The penises are barbed. I mean, it's sort of horrifying, really, the way that all goes down. And, the imagery is, can be a little bit graphic and disturbing.
Okay, so where do you want to go? What's the next animal we're going to see? Or what would you like to do that you haven't gotten the chance to do yet?
The footage aspect of this is probably the biggest limiting factor. A lot of the very, very rare high-end footage is incredibly and prohibitively expensive. So I try to keep the budgets small and reasonable. And so there was a collaboration that I did with BBC where I was able to do two animals in particular that were very, very hard to get footage for. One was the naked mole rat, and the other one was the star-nosed mole. And they had incredible footage on those. The platypus still is very difficult to get footage for, especially it's so hard. You know, it lives most of its life in the water, and water shots I don't think really get at what a crazy animal that is. I think that, you know, you really do need to have a lot of good close up on dry land shots. You need shots of the babies. The platypus, I believe, like the echidna, has a very interesting mammary structure. It's sort of like these milk patches. There's a lot of very specific media that you would need to really put that together in a way that like really kills it. I think the armadillo is coming. You know, for me, the pink fairy armadillo was definitely just kind of pushed me completely in that direction, because they're just incredible animals.
I actually just had to inhale a squeal right there.
Oh yeah, it's a great animal. It's a really, really amazing animal. The wombat is another animal that I want, but I also want to do a lot of the animals that we think we know quite a bit about. The cat, certainly. The dog is a little too broad. We'll see. But there's so many crazy animals out there.
Well, just for example, you did the chameleon, and I can honestly say that I had no idea that it was a myth that chameleons change color to blend in with their surroundings.
That was really, really surprising to me. That's another one where I kind of got caught a little bit, because the shots of the chromatophores are actually cuttlefish chromatophores. So in the chameleon one has cuttlefish chromatophores. The cuttlefish apparently has some sort of a bobtailed squid. So there's like little snafus here and there, but there aren't, you know, the overall transparency of the cuttlefish skin allows you to see the chromatophores in action. It's curious, and it's also very low. Like the on land color changing happens a lot slower, it seems like. Like the cuttlefish, it is literally like a high definition television. It happens instantaneously. They can do texture changes too, which is really remarkable. I mean, I think, you know, pound for pound, with the exception of the sea pig, maybe, I think the cuttlefish is the most interesting overall animal that I've covered. But the sea pig, you know, that's close second.
Your enthusiasm warms my heart, sir. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
And honestly, anything, any video that you do at this point, you just keep producing them and we'll keep watching them. You're lovely.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for being here.
All right. See you, Desiree. Bye.
Bye. And we'll be right back for Rochelle Saunders' interview with Derek Lowe about dangerous or otherwise disturbing chemicals after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at the ethical issues raised by the use and misuse of medical technology. Desiree Schell speaks to author Alan Hornblum about his book Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. And she'll talk to science journalist Erica Check Hayden about the controversy over genetic tests for social traits. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with chemist Dr. Derek Lowe. He has degrees in chemistry from both Hendricks College and Duke and has been working in the drug industry since 1989. In that time, he's worked on drugs to treat diseases including diabetes, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, osteoporosis, and MS. He's been blogging prolifically at In the Pipeline since 2002, which makes his one of the longest-running science blogs on the internet. Welcome to the show, Derek.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, you've been blogging for a really long time. You've been blogging really prolifically since then as well. What first got you started?
I'd always enjoyed talking about what I do, and when I ran into people at parties or, you know, standing in line at the supermarket or what have you, you know, if we got to talking, I'd tell them I discovered drugs for a living, and everyone always said, wow, you know, that's a really interesting job. And people didn't realize that folks had that job. So when I started reading blogs, I thought, you know, I should do that. I've got my own printing press now. I should talk about drug discovery and chemistry. And it just sort of took off.
Your blog is pretty wide-ranging. You primarily talk about your experiences in the blog industry, but you don't just talk about your work in particular. You also talk about the way the industry is perceived sort of year from year.
Sure. Why
stray into that topic? Why not keep things just kind of 100% hardcore chemistry?
That's the other thing. Whenever I would talk to people and say I work in the drug industry, of course, you get a mixed reaction. You get people thinking, oh, that's great. You know, I hope you discover something. And then you'd have people saying, why are my drugs so expensive? And as the years go on, I tell them because of me. Because I've, as you said, I've been doing this since 1989. But so far, I have never yet worked on anything that a sick person has put in their mouth. And that's not untypical. It's not that I'm really terrible at this job. That's actually pretty much how it goes. It's very rare to actually find a drug. So you get all sorts of reactions when you mention that you're in the drug industry. So I thought it's useless to pretend that everyone loves us. Let's talk about what the real attitudes are and if anything can be done to change them.
Okay, so what I really want to talk to you today actually has nothing to do with what you do on a daily basic drug chemistry.
Oh, it's actually closer than you'd think.
Okay, excellent. What I'm really interested in is you have a category on your blog called Things I Won't Work With, which
yes.
is fantastic. So first of all, tell us about the general theme of this blog category for those who haven't read it.
It speaks for itself. I mean, I'm an organic chemist, so I work with a lot of different chemicals, and there are a lot of things I work with day to day that most people would be a little leery of just because they don't know them or they haven't worked with them or they sound kind of scary or odd. And there are a few things which, you know, really are hazardous. I have no problem working with solutions of cyanide and things like that, which would certainly be bad news if I were to mess around with them, which I don't. But there's a category even beyond that. There are things that even I won't touch. You know, life is too short. I don't want it to get even shorter.
So this section of your blog is fascinating. It is sometimes really frightening. And a lot of the times it's really hilarious because of the way you write it. The fact that there are people out there who actually work with these chemicals, I assume volunteer to work with these kinds of chemical compounds is, I don't even know.
Yeah, it's a little alarming to me. Once in a while, I come across a paper where the people were clearly such buckaroos that I can't even imagine doing this stuff. There are indeed reagents that I will not work work with, I will not even let into my lab. I don't even know anyone who would work with them, but there are people out there. I don't know if they just have a lot better technique than I have, or they don't value their own lives as much, or whatever. They have a lot more curiosity than I have about that field, but they're willing.
I wonder if maybe they just have a better pair of running shoes.
In some cases, yeah. As you mentioned, there's one of these things, the chlorine trifluoride, where the rocket engineer who talked about it recommended that for some of the situations. That actually was a good one, because there was a huge spill of that awful chemical back in the 50s when they were trying to see if it was a good rocket propellant. It's not. It makes a tremendous rocket, but it's just too god-awful to handle. But they spilled a ton of the stuff onto a concrete floor when a metal tank broke open. And remarkably, no one was injured or killed. And that's because everyone in there knew plenty about chlorine trifluoride, and they knew that it could not be stopped. There was nothing you could do. You could not put out the fire. All that would happen if you hung around was you would get killed. So everyone, I imagine, just set their own personal speed record getting out of there. So everyone was fine. They just let it burn. And the problem is, this isn't just an ordinary fire, clearly. It's also giving off clouds of hot hydrofluoric acid. And hydrofluoric acid is very nearly one of the things I won't work with. I'll work with its water solution. But the pure gas is very, very bad. So you've got this horrible fire you can't put out, and it's giving off hot, billowing clouds of this horribly toxic, corrosive gas. It's just got everything you need.
Why do we make this stuff? Does it have a purpose? Or
apparently, the semiconductor industry uses it. If you look into these things, the semiconductor industry uses a lot of absolutely hideous chemicals. But that's because they're trying to clean off the surface of all these chips free of everything. They need incredibly perfect surfaces with nothing left on them. And if you want to clean something off where there's nothing left, these are the sorts of substances you want. But, you know, I have all sorts of categories. I have things like chlorine trifluoride, which are just horribly reactive. There are things on there that I won't mess with because they just blow up so easily and so horribly. There are incredibly toxic things. There are things that smell like nothing you've ever encountered in your life, and so on.
Speaking of smell, I wanted to talk about, and I might screw the name of this chemical name up. Sorry, dear listeners, but thioacetone?
Perfect.
Did I get that? Oh, excellent.
Yep.
So what is it and why does it make your list?
Thioacetone is actually probably the smallest, simplest chemical on the whole list. Acetone is pretty familiar as nail polish remover, and it's in paint thinners and paint strippers and things like that. Very common industrial solvent. You can get acetone down at the hardware store or in the beauty aisle if you're doing the nail polish thing. But thioacetone has a very simple swap, where there used to be an oxygen atom, now there's a sulfur atom. The problem is that swap gets you into smelly trouble almost every time. If you do that for ethanol, you know, the kind of alcohol in booze, you get thioethanol, ethane thiol, which smells like a skunk with gastrointestinal trouble.
Ooh.
Or if you take phenol, which is the smell of an old-fashioned doctor's office, an old hospital disinfectant, if you substitute a sulfur there, you get thiophenol, which is burning rubber. Concentrated, pure essence of perfect burning rubber. So sulfur has that effect. And if you do that for acetone, you apparently get something that is beyond belief as far as your nose is concerned.
I read as well, I think this is the one that it actually spreads this smell over quite a large area.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing about sulfur compounds is our noses, for whatever reason, can detect the smells at ridiculously low concentrations. So other chemicals are probably spreading in the same way. It's just that we can't notice them. But your nose will pick up, you know, one part per million of something like thioacetone with no problem at all. So you'll know about it. If you're, you know, a quarter mile downwind, you'll know about it.
So people working with this chemical, I bet you they aren't well loved by their neighbors.
No one works with this chemical. Actually, probably a few people do, but this is one of those things when you dig through the scientific literature, you find very sporadic references to it. Every so often, someone takes a whack at it and they just retreat. Again, it's one of these life's too short sort of things.
How long does the smell linger for? Is it something that sticks around or does it dissipate fairly quickly?
Yeah, they'll eventually dissipate. I mean, anyone who's ever had a dog sprayed by a skunk skunk has encountered a whole brew of small sulfur compounds, chiefly butane, thiol, and a few others. And you know, you think it's never going to go away, but after a few days or a week or 2 weeks, it does eventually go away because these things oxidize in the air and they turn into things like sulfoxides that really don't smell so much. But it takes a while, and it seems, you know, time kind of passes even more slowly than usual while that's going on.
I think 2 weeks would feel like forever.
It would, yeah, yeah. So thioacetone will eventually go away, but not as quickly as you want.
So let's move on to cyanogen azide.
Cyanogen azide, yeah.
Thank you. So what is that one?
That one has got several problems. Cyanogen means cyanide with a positive charge on it rather than a negative charge. That's an unfamiliar way to have it, and it means it's quite a bit more reactive. Cyanogen bromide is a fairly common chemical in organic synthesis, and nobody likes it. Very toxic, very volatile, probably has a horrible smell too, although I couldn't tell you. But cyanogen azide has the bonus of having this azide group. That one is very simple to write the formula. It's N3, three nitrogen atoms in a row. And when you start stacking up nitrogens, you're asking for trouble because they generally want to turn back into N2, which is nitrogen gas that we're surrounded by in the air. It's a very stable compound, very happy, and anytime another chemical has a chance to turn into nitrogen, it does so with a whoop and a holler and gives off a lot of energy.
So now this one, I've heard that you can only work with in really small concentrations.
Oh yeah, yeah. You would be out of your mind to really get a good amount of this stuff together because any small molecule with an azide is a potential explosive. And cyanogen azide, if you do the formula, it has one carbon and four nitrogens. So it's most of the way to being an expanding cloud of nitrogen gas. It would really like to turn into one. And when it does, it's going to do that all of a sudden, very loudly and very surprisingly. So like a lot of these high nitrogen compounds, you would be well advised to only make quantities that you can just barely see.
It seems like there are some sort of things you kind of red flag. I noticed reading through the blog, anytime there's a lot of nitrogen present, you tend to be like,
Absolutely. Any chemist will look at these formulas and go, no. You know, you see a lot of nitrogen. You see some particular elements. Most chemists don't like working with, say, cadmium or tellurium because they tend to be very smelly and very toxic. And there's a few other functional groups. Some of the sulfur things I was talking about. Any experienced chemist will look at these and go, hold it right there. You know, let's talk about this.
Why are companies or chemists actually trying to create these chemicals then if they are so dangerous?
Well, you know, it takes all kinds. There are some lunatics out there, but there are some reasons to do it. There's a fellow over at the university in Munich called Thomas Klepetke. Klepetke works with all kinds of very, very volatile and dangerous chemicals. And partly he's doing it because of the old mountaineering reason, because it's there. What he's trying to do is he's trying to push the boundaries of what can be a stable structure. How far can you go and still have these things hold together? And what does that tell us about chemical bonding? And there are some questions like that you can only answer, where you can only find out you've gone too far once you've gone too far.
So he just keeps going.
He just keeps going. And he actually does a very good job of it. His people are very well trained. They have good lab technique. They work in very small quantities. They know what they're doing. But anyone who tries to make these things who doesn't know what they're doing is asking for serious, serious trouble.
Now, I think that recently you had written a blog post about some research this lab was doing on a particularly unstable chemical. Azides?
Yeah.
Am I even close?
Klepetke. You know, I talked about the azide group having those three nitrogens. Klepetke's people have been trying to see how many nitrogens can you cram into a molecule? How many nitrogens in a row can you have? What's the highest percentage of nitrogen you can get into something that's stable? So they have all these formula that look like typographical errors to most chemists. They really look like someone leaned on the keyboard, you know, while they were typing their N's. And you look at them and say, that can't be stable. You know, you're joking. But they are. And oddly, some of them are not so bad to work with. And that's another thing. You look at some of these structures and you think, well, that's going to blow up, you know, if you breathe on it. But some of them are weirdly stable. So they're also trying to figure out, How come this doesn't blow up? What's stabilizing it? So they've learned some interesting stuff.
So while they're sort of on this search for stability, I know that they've also found some super unstable things. As I recall, there was one that they even had trouble shining light on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that one, they couldn't do anything with it because when you make these small quantities, you want to make just enough to characterize it by the kind of instruments we use, NMR, infrared spectra, all sorts of things like that. And these guys couldn't even shine an infrared beam on it without it blowing up. It's really, that got a lot of people's respect because shining an IR beam on something is not very strenuous. This is about as mild a thing as you can do to it. And if that blows it up, this is clearly a compound that's right on the edge of existence. And if you make a lot of it, you're going to be right on the edge of existence.
Unless you can somehow make it from very far away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or with a robot that you don't care about.
So these chemicals aren't just really dangerous, but also incredibly expensive to make if you're, you know, blowing up spectrometers left, right, and center.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of them are. But oddly, there are some very, very horrible chemicals that are very easy to make. And frankly, some of those I don't even go into very much on the blog because I don't want people to be tempted to experiment with them. Now, this stuff is out there on the internet. If you're determined to blow yourself up in your kitchen, you can do it. But I'm not going to make that any easier.
That's probably a good idea.
There was one, actually, some years ago, I did a whole series on chemical warfare agents. And when I got to talking about the nerve gases, which obviously I won't work with either, I did put in sort of a public service announcement because I thought, you know, what sort of person would try to make nerve gas? Well, I don't want to meet them, and I'd rather they weren't around. So I mentioned that if you were going to make some of this stuff, that when you got to the final step, you should rub some of it behind your ear. And if it feels soapy, you need to distill it again. I'm hoping someone took that advice.
Now, this one I'm going to have a hard time pronouncing.
Oh, go for it.
Dimethylcadmium?
Dimethylcadmium.
Dimethylcadmium. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah, dimethylcadmium. That's a recent entry. That one, I have actually met one or two people who have worked with it, but it's not me, believe me. Cadmium is not a nice metal. It's one of your heavy metals when you start talking about heavy metal poisoning like mercury and lead. Cadmium's right up there with those guys. And dimethylcadmium is a volatile liquid. So if you're looking for a way to breathe stuff like lead and mercury and cadmium, then you want to go to the methyl derivatives. But believe me, don't go there. You don't want a more efficient way to spread this all around the room air.
Now, this one is actually both highly explosive and really poisonous.
Yeah, it's got a lot going for it. It has very heavy vapor, so it's kind of hard to contain. And it catches on fire when it sits in moist air. If it doesn't catch on fire, it forms an explosive skin of some sort of peroxide that no one really understands very well. And when it burns, it gives off toxic soot. So there's no way to win with this stuff.
If someone creates this and then needs to get rid of it, how do you do that?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Now, that's a problem. I think that you would probably drip it into some sort of acid and make a cadmium salt out of it, because then at least you have an aqueous solution of something that's not going to catch on fire and is not going to vaporize around the lab. Your main thing is stop it from being dimethyl cadmium and turn it into some other form of cadmium, which is bad but not as hideous as the dimethyls. Most of the metals, the methyl derivatives, the simplest organic derivatives of them are lively. They catch on fire, they explode, they stink, they poison. They've got a lot to say.
What worries me is that there's actually information in the science research about how this stuff smells.
Oh, yeah.
How is that possible?
Oh, I know. You wonder if it's written on somebody's tombstone, you know, that was their last words, funny smell or something. And what gets me is some of these things, they say it has a distinctive odor. Well, thanks a lot. You know, a lot of things have a distinctive odor. I'm sure it's not a distinctive odor of lilacs, but I don't know what it actually is. Although at the same time, I should have a little more sympathy because I've smelled a lot of chemicals that are very hard to describe. Even common laboratory solvents like pyridine. Pyridine smells hideous, but I can't tell you what it smells like because there's nothing else that smells like pyridine. It smells like, you know, like exhaust from a UFO, I suppose. It's just really bizarre and hideous.
Dimethylcadmium, is there an application for something like this? I really hope there isn't.
There is, but everyone who uses it is trying to find a way to stop using it. You can make these very, very small particles of cadmium sulfide, which are called quantum dots, and they're actually really useful in physics and nanochemistry. But the best way to make them for years was to use dimethyl cadmium. And if you look through the literature, you find all these people trying to find some way around this. I think maybe they have. I think people can now make cadmium sulfide quantum dots without the stuff. If they have, I congratulate them, because I know that they are hating every minute of it.
That is a service to all the scientists who have to work with it, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. There are probably some very interesting reactions and syntheses that could be done with some of these compounds. With nickel carbonyl does some interesting reactions, but I won't touch that stuff. I don't know, though, because if there's a great reaction that would save me all kinds of time using one of these, I'd rather not know. I'd rather not have the temptation of using it.
In your work in the drug industry, are there obviously not these chemicals, because we've already established that you won't work with them, but sure. Are there dangerous chemicals that you have to interact with on a regular basis that, you know, other people go, nope, won't touch that?
Up to a point, yeah. There are certainly things that, you know, are flammable and poisonous and the like. So, yeah, I've worked with some things that are probably on other people's won't work with list. So as long as you treat them with respect, you're okay. But to get on the things that I won't even work with list, it has to be something that respect is not enough. You know, these chemicals are just too hideous. So I like feeling that I have some control over the reaction, or I know how to contain these things or how to minimize them. But something like chlorine trifluoride, there is no way to contain that stuff.
Yeah, if something goes wrong, it's not going to go a little bit wrong. It's going to go really, really wrong.
Yeah.
Derek, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, glad to. Enjoy talking about him.
If you want to learn more about dangerous chemistry or about his work in the drug industry, you can find Derek Lowe at pipeline.corante.com. And that link will be available in our show notes. You can find those show notes on our website. And there you can also find links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and our Google Plus feed. Also, click over to us on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, download past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.